Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. A Time magazine headline asked, New Orleans cuisine, is it safe to eat the po' boy? Now, a multi-government agency has been established to try and ensure that food coming out of the Gulf of Mexico is safe. Joining me this hour to discuss what the government is doing to keep contaminated fish off the market, from his office in Silver Spring, Maryland, Don Kramer. He's acting deputy director of the FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks, Susan.
And from Miami, Steve Murawski. He is the chief fishery scientist for NOAA. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Susan.
And in the studio with me, Caroline Smith-DeWall with the Center for Science and the Public Interest and the Washington Post, David Farenthold. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, David, let's start with you. Tell us briefly, what did Vice President Biden announce this week when he was down in Louisiana?
Earlier this week, he announced that the states, the Gulf states and the federal government had all agreed to work together in deciding how to reopen areas of the Gulf that are now closed for seafood. They had agreed on a common protocol for deciding when the shellfish from those areas was deemed safe to eat.
Do you think this was a tough agreement to reach?
Well, it had been something that had been a real subject of disagreement between the states and the federal government. But I think they all realized that the key to this whole thing is that everybody has complete confidence in this food. So if there was, it doesn't help any of them if there's any disagreements seen between these parties.
So, Caroline, we're going to talk about what the government is doing. But let's talk just very briefly about what consumers should be doing. Is there anything that you think consumers should be doing to make sure that the seafood that they buy and eat is safe?
Susan, I think everyone will agree that this is a horrible environmental and economic tragedy, and it's clearly affecting people, the fishing community in the Gulf Coast region. I think our hearts all go out to them. It is critical, though, that FDA not sugarcoat the issues here. The programs that they have announced are good. The fact that they have closed such a large body of water is certainly good. But the reality of enforcement and also their ability to test what's coming through the Gulf means that this is really a buyer beware situation for consumers.
So when you say buyer beware, what would, if we wanted to go out this afternoon and buy some shrimp or some oysters, what would we do? What would be the smart thing to do?
Well, it's important. There is a country of origin label on it, which means you will be able to identify products coming from other countries. Unfortunately, we don't have similar traceability systems for products harvested in the U.S. So you can check the label of where it's coming from. If you're at a restaurant, you can also ask your server where it's sourced.
Well, if it were you, would you avoid buying fresh seafood from the Gulf of Mexico at this point?
Well, the Deputy Commissioner for Foods at FDA 2 weeks ago testified in Congress and said that all seafood coming out of the Gulf Coast that's on the market today is safe. Well, unfortunately, I think he's sugarcoating and overstating what they actually know. First of all, it wasn't safe before the oil spill. They've had major problems with Vibrio vulnificus, for example, in the shellfish, and also with mercury problems and some heavy metals in the fish. So it wasn't entirely safe to begin with. But secondly, the program that they've announced is highly dependent, number one, on enforcement. How are they going to enforce the no fishing zones? These are huge, and they'll take a huge amount of enforcement capacity, which the states and the federal government don't have. And secondly, the fact that they're really only testing of the seafood that's coming in a very small percentage.
Well, Don Kramer, you're there at the FDA. Tell us, what about this charge of sugarcoating? Do you think the FDA is doing enough to make sure that the food that Americans might buy is safe?
Thanks, Susan. I guess first what I'd like to say is to echo some of Caroline's opening comments. Just for me personally and for those of us at FDA, we we look at the news about the Gulf, and we feel the same way, I think, that folks across the country feel, and that's very saddened about the economic consequences, about the cultural consequences, and certainly about the environmental consequences. I think the good news is that we at FDA, as well as our partners at NOAA and the state agencies, both the state fisheries and the state public health agencies, take our jobs about ensuring the safety of seafood very seriously. We don't want to have a situation where consumers have to have a buyer beware attitude about the food they purchase, and we don't believe that that is the case at the current time. We think a very robust program in place. The closures, as Caroline pointed out, are the centerpiece for ensuring safety of the seafood. There's no level of testing that FDA or the states could do that could individually ensure lot by lot or fish by fish that the seafood coming from the Gulf is safe. So what we have to do is put preventive controls in place to make sure that unsafe fish is not available, is not on the market. And we believe that is, in fact, what's happened. NOAA and Steve is on with us as well, has taken what we believe is a very precautionary approach to ensuring that the closures are sufficiently protective. And we've been working with the states in the same way to make sure that their closures are protective. And the announcement that was talked about a little earlier of a joint protocol for reopening ensures that all of the players are going to play by the same rules, that is federal and state, and that we can all collectively stand shoulder to shoulder and say that the necessary steps are being taken by the government so consumers can have confidence in what seafood is on the market.
So, Don, would you have personally any hesitation about buying any seafood that was on the market here in the United States for your own family?
No, none whatsoever.
Steve, tell us about what it is that NOAA is doing and the difference between what NOAA is doing and what the FDA is doing.
Thank you, and I'd like to echo some of Don's comments here. NOAA is primarily charged with, number one, under the Madison-Stevens Fisheries Act, to close areas when there's these kinds of threats. And under that act, every day we get a report of where oil is and where it's forecasted to be, and we have been adjusting those closures. And so one can go to a NOAA website every morning at noontime and see if there are any changes. The current area is around 80,000 square miles, which is about a third of the entire U.S. Federal waters in the Gulf of Mexico, and there's a buffer zone around where we think oil is and has been. And so our approach here, number one, as Don said, was to be very precautionary in closing those areas. Number two, we've been doing a considerable amount of sampling, both within those closed areas and around the edges. Within 6 days of that well sinking, there were background samples that have been taken, and those have been analyzed in two ways. Number one, analyzed in what we call sensory testing, which is smelling and tasting, and the human nose is quite sensitive to the presence of oil and dispersants. And number two, with chemical analysis. And I can tell you that those chemical analyses predate any oil coming into the areas that are now oiled, and we've also been sampling in the closed area. In the important thing is, of all the chemical analysis samples that we've done, and we have nearly 1,500 samples now, we have not seen any sample exceed any of the control levels of concern for the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, which are the chemicals of concern. On the enforcement issue, I wanted to speak to that because you can imagine there's a significant amount of Coast Guard presence around this area right now for a variety of reasons. And we have actually detained a number of fishing vessels who were fishing at the margins, and their catch was confiscated. And so there is a vigorous enforcement action going on here in addition to the precautionary closures.
Now, it's interesting you talked about sensory testing. So these are people who just smell the fish that's being processed or is for sale. And how you say the human nose is pretty sensitive. Can it really tell if there's any oil in a fish?
Well, it's interesting. It's a little more scientific than you'd think. What we have is a panel of 10 trained people, and they've been trained on the particular oil that's involved in the spill, as well as the dispersants that are being used. And so those panelists have been trained outside the region so that they're not, you know, potentially biased by anything that might be in the air. And so the criterion we have is for the sensory work is 7 out of 10 have to pass an individual sample. If the sample passes the sensory test, and the human nose is sensitive down to about one part per million in oil, so that's a very small amount. If those samples pass that, then they get screened for chemical analysis, and we have a laboratory in Seattle that's up and running and processing all these samples. So there's sort of a two-way analysis in order to do this. And one of the things I wanted to talk about was once we cap off the well and the oil stops flowing, then at a certain rate, the oil would dissipate in the waters, and then there'll be great concern about reopening criteria. We will not open any areas unless they are tested through this formal process to try to make sure that no samples reach the market.
Well, we're all looking forward to the day when that well is capped. David?
I just had a question about the fact that you haven't found any levels of concern in any of the samples you're taking. Does that show you maybe that your testing service testing criteria doesn't work that well? And if you haven't found any negative findings, how are you going to know when it's okay to allow an area to open back up if there's no sort of flaw to get rid of?
That's a good question, David. Thank you. In terms of the sampling we've done, I said that we have detected no contamination in any samples relative to the stands we have. We actually have one sample that failed sensory, right? And that was a sample right up near the area that's heavily oiled. In terms of those standards, the chemical standards are quite sensitive.
And we're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to pick up our conversation again, continue it. My apologies for interrupting you there. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about the safety of seafood from the Gulf Coast in the wake of this terrible oil spill. And we've been talking with Steve Murawski, who's Director of Scientific Programs and the Chief Science Advisor for NOAA, Don Kramer, who's Acting Deputy Director of the FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, David Farenthold, a Washington Post environmental reporter, and Caroline Smith-DeWall, who's Director of Food Safety for the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Shortly, we're going to go to the phones. We'll take some of your questions. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Steve, I interrupted you when we went to that break. Was there anything else you wanted to say?
Well, I just wanted to mention that different kinds of seafood accumulate and dissipate oil in different ways. And so for fin fishes and mammals and other things, they actually metabolize oil products extremely quickly. And so they will actually go out of the flesh within a matter of days when the oil is actually stopped. Other species like oysters and shrimp, they may accumulate more. And so those are going to be sort of watched extra carefully in terms of what we're trying to do in terms of reopening.
You know, we're talking about the threat that the oil spill poses. Caroline, what about the effect or potential hazards from the dispersants that are being used in the Gulf?
Well, we have looked at the dispersants, and clearly some of the chemicals involved are highly toxic. Some are carcinogens. FDA has made the point and testified in Congress recently that these dispersants don't actually accumulate in the fish, which was a major concern of ours. But they admitted that they haven't actually done some of the testing that would confirm this. They haven't. Senator Harkin, I believe, asked the question of whether they'd actually tested live fish with the dispersants to see what type of effects that could have. So at this point, we have to rely on FDA's best judgment regarding the dispersants, but I think they'll even admit they need to do more testing.
Don, what do you think about that and the possible risks to consumers from these dispersants?
I think the short answer is we don't believe that there is a risk posed. And that certainly sounds implausible when we think about and certainly what we're hearing about the potential impacts of these dispersants in the marine environment on fish, on the health of fish species. So I think right away you hear that and you say, well, why could that be? And what we have to be able to do is to separate the impact of these dispersants on marine animals, especially low order marine animals that can be exquisitely sensitive to these things, where in fact they can be exposed to the dispersant at high levels in the immediate vicinity of the well, for example, and they can even be killed at those levels. That's a significant environmental impact. We're aware of that. We're aware that these dispersants can also cause concerns to humans who handle directly high concentrations of them. So it's understandable that consumers would then be worried, well, what about my fish? The thing that separates this, or the fact that separates this issue from the other issues that I just mentioned, is that in order for a dispersant to have an impact on humans eating fish, it has to get into the flesh. That's sort of obvious. And the chemicals that are present in these dispersants, which we know what they all are, do not move across the membranes that separate the fish flesh from the environment. And these are well understood chemicals. Many of them are approved for use in foods already. And they all have low toxicity, and they all have a low, what we call bioconcentration factor, which is the is what is known about these chemicals and their ability to move into the flesh across the membranes that separate the flesh from the environment. And as a result, we have concluded that there is little likelihood of any human health concern from consumption of the fish, very different, as I said, from the environmental impacts. As Caroline said, nobody has fully studied this situation, and we think that that's important. There are studies ongoing at NOAA, and Steve can talk a little bit more about that, to answer the question, what happens if you put fish in a tank with this whole mix of dispersants and petroleum? And we're confident that those studies are going to demonstrate, in fact, what we believe to be the fact based on the science. But as a matter of precaution, we're running those studies, and if we find that they tell us something new about bioconcentration, we will certainly change our protocols, as I'm sure will the states, to take that into account.
Joining us now from St. Bernard Parish in Louisiana is George Barisic. He's a third-generation American-Croatian commercial fisherman, very familiar with these waters. Thank you so much for joining us, George.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, tell me, are you still going out and fishing every day?
I'm leaving after we get finished here. You're the last article. I did a little thing with Lenny Kravitz and CBS yesterday, and after I did another article this morning, a radio show, and now I'm done with you. I'm going to get ice, and I'm going to catch shrimp until they close it.
Now, how big an issue has it been that areas have been closed in terms of your own fishing?
Well, the first 38 days, I was totally locked up. I couldn't catch my oysters, couldn't harvest my oysters, and I couldn't catch my shrimp. You know, so that was 38 days of non-production, which is people really don't have an idea of the economic impact, because when I don't go to fuel them, I don't buy any, make any money. My deckhand don't make any money. My dealer doesn't make any money. My processor doesn't get anything in the process. So people get laid off in this chain of economic impact that is astronomical, and people are just becoming to understand it.
And now, where are you able to go fishing?
Actually, on the east side of the river, predominantly, north of the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet and toward Mississippi. Now, half of Mississippi flows. It's encroaching. It's coming forever west. But it's like the northwestern part of Lake Bourne, Lake Pontchartrain, and the Mississippi up, and that's open. But the problem is, it's only one area that's holding a few shrimp. These are shrimp and a larvae that got in the system before the oil. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So everything, the larvae that was coming through there, they didn't make it. So the first day of the season, when it did open, that was June 8th, I presume, I think, I went to the area where I normally would have a lot of production, because, you know, shrimp, to make money, I got to fill a boat up. Okay? And that's how we make money. Well, there was nothing, no fish, nothing out there, which is totally atypical. You know, that area usually holds a lot of shrimp, a lot of fish, and had nothing. So I came back, and I made me a few good trips in that one area, and another week had passed, so I went back over there because, you know, I usually do real well. I usually slam them. And I went to an area where I do, you know, well, I didn't even catch a shrimp. I caught a few fish, but it was outside fish that's not normally in the inside perimeter of the marshes. So that has to change right there. We don't know exactly what it is. Is the oil pushing them around? But the concentrations of shrimp that we usually see, and we're talking historically, not usually, historically, they're not there.
Well, now, are you yourself confident that the fish you are getting is going to be safe for people to eat?
Yeah. We're closing areas, because I work, you know, closely with the wildlife and fisheries, okay? And we're closing areas and opening areas, you know, far exceeding, you know, it's not like the oil's right here in an area just got closed. You know, we're predicting, you know, miles and miles away. It's like a big buffer zone for an area that's open and an area that's closed. You know, we will not knowingly put a tainted product on the market, because that'll put me out of business just as bad as this BP's putting me out of business.
And you said at the very beginning that it's hard for Americans elsewhere to understand the economic impact this is having. Tell us what the economic impact is on your hometown. What do you think is happening?
Well, the fishermen who are able to work for BP right now, who, you know, got into the Vessel of Opportunity program, they're starting to do okay, because BP is, you know, paying a nice per diem. You know, we had to argue, we had to fight. But those people who are not, the fishermen, the deckhands, the docks who are not getting compensated, the dock workers who are not getting compensated, the production people. We had two oyster houses that been, one of them has been open for 101 years. It's shut down the other day. Another one shut down. So one of them's got 18, 20 workers. One of them got 46 workers. The guy who buys the most shrimp in the state of Louisiana, he's got 90 workers usually this time of the year, because this is the three-month window where we, you know, produce 60-70% of our shrimp. He's got seven people working right now. So you look at that economic impact. Do the arithmetic.
Well, we hope things turn around there. Thanks so much for joining us, George Baratsich.
Good morning.
Good morning. He's a commercial fisherman from St. Bernard Parish in Louisiana. Steve, NOAA is doing some research in the Gulf addressing this issue. Tell us what's happening there.
The broader issue of seafood safety?
Yes, and in the Gulf in particular. I understand you have some research vessels out in the Gulf testing the water and trying to figure out what's going on, looking at research.
Indeed, we do. We have three large research ships and three smaller research ships that are out there, as well as a number of commercial fishing boats that are contracted to us. And our strategy right now with the ships is, number one, to make sure that we extend our background samples both on the Florida shelf and down towards Texas, including Texas waters, because honestly, none of us really know what this scenario is going to portend over the next few months. It's clear it's going to be with us for a while, and depending on where this oil is transported, we want to make sure we have good background samples so we know what we're looking at. So the ships are out right now. One of the ships that was down towards the Mexican border was blown in, of course, with the hurricane. But they're out there sampling to the east and west. And we also have a vessel that left from Key West the other day. And that is specifically targeting swordfish and yellowfin tuna, which are these large animals that have a substantial amount of migratory behavior. And what we want to do is make sure that if animals are potentially getting oiled in the closed area and they're migratory and they migrate across the border, that we understand the potential for them to be oiled fish. And so they're not only working in the southern part of this closed area down near southern Florida, but also working their way up both in the closed area, and they will eventually work outside as well, to make sure that we've got yet another layer of protection on this. Over and above that work, we're also quite interested, as your previous guest said, about what's happening to the fish themselves, what's happening to the fish, what's happening to the marine mammals, and what's happening to the turtles. So a number of other vessels are working on those problems.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to go to the phones now and take some of your calls. We'll go to Janet first. She's calling us from Florida. Janet, where in Florida are you?
Near Ocala.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for...
Right in Central Florida. Right. It's a common pastime for Floridians in particular to go scalloping and take our families and retrieve shellfish. And I'm concerned about personal consumption. We just went to Crystal River when they opened the scalloping season early and got a bunch of scallops, and now we have our annual trip planned for Steen Hatchie in the end of July. So first I was concerned about whether or not there's any information about personal consumption of that type of shellfish right now, and secondly, I'm also interested in hearing what I think your panelists from the Center for Science and the Public Interest, what sort of work they're doing. I have particularly high regard for the work that they do, and I'd like to know what sort of efforts they're making with regard to the Gulf spill and the food safety.
All right, Janet, thank you so much for your call. Caroline.
Thank you, and it sounds like a terrific pastime to go down there and collect those scallops. I do want to caution you that the biggest risk you face right now is probably a risk you faced in the past, and that's Vibrio vulnificus. You want to be very careful about serving those scallops raw, and especially to any members of your family who are diabetics, who might have hemochromatosis, liver disease, or be treating for cancer. If they are at all immune suppressed, they face a very serious illness. So I just want to caution about that.
But now that's not related to the oil spill, is that right?
No. With respect to the oil spill, this oil spill is being watched very, very carefully. So I would watch for both your responses from NOAA and also from your local Environmental Protection Agency to determine whether the risk is different than it was last year. Once the oil gets into those beds, you probably won't be able to harvest there again. So hopefully the waters won't allow that to happen.
Don, what would you say to Janet? Any advice for her?
Yeah, I think the best advice with respect to concerns that come from the oil spill would be to adhere to the commercial closures. So don't concern yourself whether they're commercial or recreational closures. They should be respected nonetheless. And if you're harvesting from areas that are not subject to a state or federal closure, the product should be just as safe as it ever was, because we're looking at what we call sentinel species. Steve Murawski mentioned that before. We're aware of those species that are the ones that are most likely to pick up the contaminants from the spill, and these tend to be mollusks like scallops and oysters, for example. And we're also aware of the ones that tend to hang on to the contaminants longest, and they are the same species. So we tend to call these sentinel species, and we're watching these very carefully and adjusting any closures as necessary based on what we see.
All right, Janet, thanks so much for your call. David, bring us up to speed on what's happening in efforts to end the oil spill. How are things going?
Well, the people have heard about the relief well, which is a well that's being drilled near the site of the leaking BP well that they're saying is proceeding ahead of schedule. They're saying now, originally they had said it would be finished in August. This is something where it's going to go thousands of feet below the floor of the Gulf itself and drill into the pipe. Imagine finding a 7-inch pipe thousands of feet below the seafloor. They're going to drill into that and plug it. Originally they had said maybe August for that. Now we're talking about July. But we've always been cautioned that this is such a tricky process, actually, you know, not just drilling down, but then actually finding the right spot, that process could take longer. We've always been cautioned that it looks ahead of schedule, but we won't be sure until they're right there.
And Steve, after the well is capped, how long will there continue to be concern about the environmental impact and the safety of seafood from this area?
Well, it's going to be a little bit of what do we find? Clearly we've got a lot of oil in the water column, dispersed oil. And so what we're going to do is monitor that area very closely, both in terms of the seafood, but also what is happening to the surface oil. And then there is also a fairly vigorous program looking at subsurface oil as well. We have a vessel that can actually tow an instrument down to a couple hundred meters, around 600 feet, and it can actually find submerged oil. And so what we'll do is, once that's capped, do a number of surveys up around the wellhead, et cetera, and look for not only the surface expression, which is monitored with satellites, different kinds of airplanes, both NASA and NOAA airplanes, as well as with vessels, but also do this subsurface work to try to make sure that there isn't a source of oil that's going to keep, you know, either polluting beaches or getting into the seafood. But, you know, once the edges start to dissipate,
right,
there'll be great pressure to reopen this area.
And once again, we're going to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll take your calls.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
Some long-married couples decide to go their separate ways and create new lives for their remaining years. The unique challenges and opportunities of late-life divorce. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We've got an email from Ed. He writes about a program he heard on NPR about fishermen fishing by flashlight and harvesting fish for themselves just feet from dead, oil-tainted fish. And he writes, if they are glad to eat the fish for themselves, you know they are willing to sell that fish to someone else. Basic human greed dictates that. So contrary to government claims that all the fish is fine to eat, And since we know that all fish and all meat is not tested by the USDA or other similar agencies, any claims they are making that all the fish sold from Louisiana producers is safe is not credible to me. Don, what would you say to Ed, first of all, about this question about fishermen circumventing your efforts to make sure the fish is safe?
Well, I think it's fair to say that there's no system that's fail-safe. We, as Steve mentioned before, we have an aggressive federal program to ensure to keep violators out of the closed waters and federal waters, and the states have similar programs as they normally do for ensuring that the fisheries laws in those states are being adhered to. We think this is going to work well. We also believe, as the fisherman that you had on earlier mentioned, this does not serve the industry well for them to attempt to cheat the system. And we believe that most of the industry is well aware of that and does want someday to be able to get back to where they were, and we certainly hope they can. But there'll always be cheaters, of course, and I think the best thing that we can do to deal with those who do manage to get through the different layers of control that we have here would be to say that we are certainly interested in any information about that. FDA has a toll-free number that we would encourage folks to call, whether this is a fisherman who has pulled up fish in an area that he believes to be open or where harvesting is allowed and yet finds what he thinks is chemical contamination, or whether this is a consumer that gets a hold of some fish that they think might have been subjected to contamination. I'd like to give that number. That's 1-800-INFO, I-N-F-O, FDA, and we would certainly follow up on any information that we get from consumers or the fishing community.
Carolyn.
I just have to laugh and challenge Dawn a bit on the layers of control. Susan, it's much more like a fishing net, and there are lots of holes. This issue of enforcement is a key one. We know that there's been a lot of illegal harvesting, for example, of shellfish coming out of this region in the Gulf. I remember TV documentaries showing guys coming in with a lot of shellfish that was illegally harvested. So we know this has been happening in the past. I think your speaker from NOAA was just getting to the issue before the break of the pressure that's going to be on them to reopen these fishing waters after the leak is capped.
Steve, I'd like to ask you that because, of course, we heard from the fishermen down in Louisiana how devastating this has been to the economy there. But, of course, for most Americans, their concern is really about can we trust the fish to be safe? Is there a conflict there, and will there be pressure to open waters just as soon as you can justify doing that?
Well, certainly with such a large amount of this area closed, and these are very productive waters, that the fishermen want to go get their businesses reestablished and go fishing. What I'm telling you is that, however, we will not open any of those waters unless the animals in the waters actually meet both the sensory and the chemical testing standards that we've established. And so again, our role here is going to be making sure that we have the capacity to sample all those areas and the areas that are proposed for opening in ways that we can do it on a timely basis. And over the next month or so, we're going to be ramping up to probably at least 12 commercial chartered fishing vessels that will be working for us so that we have the pace in order to actually do this in a way that's safe for the public and that's expedient for the fishermen.
David.
Steve, I just want to get back to a subject earlier. I think people may be troubled by the idea that you're going to test for things that you're not finding now. How are people going to know that things have improved in those areas if only one sample has turned out badly?
Well, one of the things that we're going to do over the next month or so is actually do some very targeted sampling in around the area, the area that's coated most with oil right now, so that we can actually see what potentially really hot samples look like. And it'll be very telling if we're in areas that are heavily impacted that the fish in there are, in fact, clearing relatively quickly. So we will be doing enough work there so that we can understand the magnitude of this problem once the reopening process starts in earnest.
All right, let's go to Karen. She's calling us from Sayville, New York. That's out on Long Island. Hi, Karen.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call today. My husband and I are restaurant owners in New York, and on Long Island, of course. We're on the coast, and people in our restaurant are beginning to ask us where our fish is coming from, and we were just wondering, what do we say? There's really becoming a great concern in other areas outside of Louisiana and the Gulf.
And what do you say? when customers ask you?
We tell them that we've been buying our fish from a distributor here named George Braun for a number of years. But at this point, sometimes it's getting very tricky to even know who we can trust.
Would you consider changing your menu, maybe not serving fish that come from the United States, or make dishes that don't include fish? Would you make those kind of adjustments, do you think?
Well, it's kind of difficult because being a small Italian restaurant, one of our major entrees, of course, is clam sauce and mussels and other mollusk types of fish. So those are some of the main things on our menu. And what one of my concerns was is, what is the FDA advising restaurants to do at this point?
All right, let's ask the FDA. Don, what are you advising restaurants like Karen to do?
And I'm glad I have the opportunity to respond. And it's certainly natural that consumers are going to be concerned. I can't imagine that folks with the day-to-day coverage that they're seeing about the environmental impacts that are out there, I can't imagine consumers not being concerned. But as we started out in this hour, as I said, and I would like to repeat it, all of us here, both in the federal and state governments that have the responsibility for seafood safety, take our jobs very seriously. And we are taking all of the appropriate steps to make sure that there is no added risk associated with Gulf Coast product that is on the market. And, or said another way, that any product that has an increased risk is kept off of the market, and we're doing that through a series of steps. The first is very protective closures, and this hasn't been covered in great detail here, but the closures both at the federal and state level are not just where the oil is, but where the oil is predicted to go, and then beyond that, buffer zones. So we believe we are very protective in what fish is allowed to be harvested. And then, as Steve Morawski was explaining before, testing is being done at the perimeters here, and those samples are turning up clean, and that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing that we're finding clean fish at the perimeters of the closures. That's exactly what we would want to find. And then beyond that, we have controls that the seafood industry is putting in place to make sure they're only buying fish from areas that are acceptable for harvest. And then as a final check, we're doing some marketplace sampling to make sure that what's turning up on the market is not a surprise that there's any contaminants there.
Have you found any contaminants in that market testing?
No.
No. All right. Caroline.
And so I think all of these controls put together, we hope, should be reassuring to the public, and I guess that would be the message I would hope you would give to your customers.
Karen, this is Caroline Smith-DeWall from CSPI. I just wanted to tell you that clams and mollusks in Italian food can be great. The way to protect yourself is really to be purchasing them from cold waters. Cold waters overall are safer for mollusk and shellfish. They don't have the Vibrio vulnificus especially, that is so common in the Gulf Coast. So we would really recommend that you, with your buyer, you make sure that you're only purchasing those shellfish from the cold northern waters. It can be Pacific Coast or the Atlantic Coast, but cold Pacific waters cold ocean waters, and we would recommend that you do that even when there's no oil spill, because that will be safer for your customers.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time today, and I guess all we can do at this point is just say a prayer that this will be closed and that we can have a safe environment again. Thank you.
We all hope for that. Karen, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina, and talk to Mike. Mike, thanks for holding on.
Hi, yeah. Thank you for taking my call, and I just wanted to comment earlier about the characterization of some of the fishermen who might be bending or even breaking the law by fishing in or near the tainted waters of the Gulf. And I think that to characterize them as cheaters and to come down hard on them legally would be a mistake, simply because a lot of these folks are, not exactly wealthy to begin with, and they're just trying to eke by a living, and they're paying a mortgage and trying to feed their families just like the rest of us. And I think that it's important not to make the situation worse by, coming down too hard.
You know, we don't want to come down too hard on fishermen in the area, but there is this balancing interest in making sure that the seafood that Americans buy is safe. You know, David, there was quite a sad story about a man named Ellen Kruss. Tell us about him.
We wrote a lot about a charter boat captain in Orange Beach, Alabama, somebody who had taken people out fishing in the Gulf of Mexico for decades, Alan Cruz. He was somebody who had signed up to be what they call a vessel opportunity captain with BP. He was one of a lot of fishermen who, because they're not able to fish now, they've turned to BP into working in the cleanup for their income. And we wrote about him. He signed on for that, but like a lot of charter boat captains, he found that there was income in it, but it was the loss of this thing that had made their life so good before, which was independence, self-reliance, reliance on your own knowledge of the way that the Gulf worked. Instead, he became an employee of an oil company, and like a lot of other charter boat captains down there, found the system very confusing, hours long, the whole work frustrating. He committed suicide a couple of weeks ago, and people have told us that he didn't leave a note, but it's hard to know exactly what's going on in his mind. But he was somebody who was losing weight. He was depressed. He was pushed into pushed into a corner, both by the spill and also by the work that he had taken on after the spill. That's definitely a sign of what it's not universal. Some places I've talked to captains who are very happy with their work for Vessel Opportunity, but it's a sign of how hard this has been on people who make their living off the Gulf.
Yeah, definitely a tough time for that region, and much of it still recovering from Hurricane Katrina. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've been taking your calls and reading your emails. Here's an email from Alex, who writes us from Washington, D.C. He says, has the FDA and NOAA considered using dogs to perform sensory testing on seafood instead of humans? How about that, Steve and Don? Would that be a possibility?
Well, I don't think we've ever done that. It would be interesting to know if they had the capability to actually communicate their results. As I said before, this is a high skill position in terms of actually doing these sensory tests, and it takes a considerable amount of training to do this. I don't think we've ever contemplated that. It'd be interesting to know if, in fact, we could replicate the skill using, more powerful noses. I also can tell you that there are electronic noses under development to do this as well.
Electronic noses, that's interesting. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, the theory there is, you have a small aerosol that comes off of the fish if it's tainted, and that you could port that directly to a gas chromatograph that would actually look at those sample results and characterize them.
All right, let's go to Eric calling us from Alexandria. Eric, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I had a question, for Caroline Smith-DeWall or whoever else can answer it, about the I understand that there is a food safety law that it passed the House or something, and it's sort of I haven't heard anything about it recently. I wondered where that is and how it might help in responding to the oil spill. Like, would there be new enforcement authorities or recall authorities or funding, or what the benefits to that might be?
All right, Eric, thanks for your call. Caroline.
Eric, that's a great question. We have been working for over 10 years on legislation that's just sitting before the Senate right now. It's passed the House. It's really almost ready to go to the president. And it would give FDA significant new authorities, both in the enforcement area and also authorities to really help control some of these longstanding risks, as well as take more emergency action. We think the bill will help FDA, but they also will need to be adequately staffed and resourced to manage it. Enforcement of these issues is really important.
And a last email from Diane, who writes us from Dallas, Texas. Yesterday, I spent all day making a huge quantity of gumbo. I bought fresh shrimp and fresh crabs at a local Mexican grocery store. I assume Mexico to be where their fresh seafood came from, but I didn't ask. Should I and others here be worried about it? I would hate to throw away the rest of all my culinary efforts. Who'd like to handle that? Don, should she be concerned?
Well, again, I would go back to what I said earlier, the product that's on the market should be safe for consumption. And so I wouldn't ask your caller to take any particular action other than to enjoy the food.
All right, Caroline.
One thing that will definitely help, though, if this new law passes, is increased traceability. We really need to know not only if product, if seafood's coming from other countries, but it would help us to know which region of the country it's coming from. We all want to enjoy Gulf Coast shellfish and seafood, but it needs to be safe.
Caroline Smith-DeWall, she's joined us this hour along with David Farenthold from The Washington Post, Don Kramer from the FDA, and Steve Murawski from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. My thanks to you all for joining us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks. Thanks, Susan.
Thanks very much.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.